You're listening to me, Paul Andrews, and the stonkingly gorgeous Jill Serkin.
Yeah, I'm very excited about Folkestone. I just read out that, and I'll go along and see that. I love Folkestone. Have you been, Paul?
I've bought quite a few houses down there, actually.
Have you?
Around the west end of Folkestone, yeah. The west end side.
I love what they've done there.
Do you know what they've done? I don't know if you know this, but in the 1960s, it had the highest level of Rolls Royces in the country, the west end of Folkestone.
Really?
Yeah, really?
Yeah. So because you've been to the west end, it's beautiful.
Yeah, beautiful.
Yeah, absolutely stunning.
Great big houses. And I love the fact they've done that creative quarter in town. And there's a really nice Italian there on the as you go under the arch. And they allow dogs, which was really good. My dog tried to snatch a meatball off the table.
Or a chicken wing.
Chicken wing, yeah. Eyebrows have been raised over a council's takeover of a struggling cinema, with residents saying they wouldn't trust it to run a bath. Ashford Borough Council is to start operating the town's Picture House cinema by Easter, after the Cineworld-owned chain surrendered its lease. There are 26 jobs that have been saved as a result of the move, which is good, but there are fears that the six-screen site is not worth the investment, as it is often very empty. ABC, which owns the £75 million Elwick Place complex, says stepping in to run the facility is the only viable option in the short term. You know, cinema, what do we think? Because I've got quite a nice house. I've got a wood burner and stuff. I've got a sea view. I've got a dog that I can't leave because she's anxious about being left. So for me, I'll watch a Prime or a Netflix film.
Yeah, and that's
kind of nice.
That's not the message from this for me.
Right.
I'm going to have a little rant and then I'm going to shut up because we're going to talk to Paul, who's got much more interesting things to say. But I'm going to have a little rant
about
this.
Get it off his chest.
We are struggling in this country with absolutely abysmal public services.
Yeah.
Yeah, all of our councils are broke.
Yeah.
Yet they insist on building shopping centres, cinemas, and other things that they haven't got a clue how to run and not doing their basic jobs, which is providing potholeless roads, refuse collection, social care and social housing. Yet they want to get involved in everything else and they're rubbish at it. I mean, the reason they're taking over a cinema is because they allowed them to build something that's not necessary. There are three cinemas in Ashford already.
Oh, are there?
Yes.
Oh, well, that's not going to happen.
So they built another one. Yeah, that's really clever, isn't it?
That's crazy.
Yeah, there's a multi-screen cinema at Eureka Park. It's just bonkers.
Yeah.
It's like they own two shopping malls. Both of them are absolutely appalling. But on the outskirts of Ashford is the outlet centre, which is rammed every single day. You know, so why do you keep doing this, councils?
Yeah, there's so much more they could do with that space, isn't there?
No, but they don't need to do anything apart from what their job is.
In my
opinion, councils have overstretched themselves by interfering in everything they possibly can, rather than just ring fencing and focusing on what their core deliverables are. And their core deliverables are providing public services like maintaining the roads, maintaining social services, maintaining education, and refuse collection, and managing parks. Yeah,
yep.
That's it.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. They can't do any of that. They can't fill in the potholes. There's no school places around Ashford. Yeah, but they can run a cinema.
Yeah, I know.
Rant over.
It is. No, I agree with your rant. And we've got Canterbury Council where I live, and they
157 million in debt. Canterbury Council, 157 million pounds.
I spent my whole life emailing them about their failings,
and they're trying to recover it all by charging me parking.
Yeah, well, they're trying to recover it all by...
Paul, I'm telling you, I own a business in Canterbury, yeah? £18 a day to park to go to work.
That's ridiculous.
It is ridiculous. I'm always fighting with them, I'm afraid. Mm. And we had another tweet from Chartway saying, thanks for the shout-out. Maybe get Vanilla Web to have a little clean around. In here.
Clean around what? What's she saying?
In here.
It's a bit dusty, isn't it?
Well, you did dust before they came the other week, didn't you?
If they'd have got here half an hour earlier, they would have caught me in my pinium and marigolds.
I've had something else about a dating. So 2D Game Mania _ Crypto says, I met some people online previously and I'm not going down that route again, is what my daughter says. She says she hates it. I just need to go out more. And that's what she says, because she gets up at 5, she walks to work, she goes to the gym, she doesn't go out, she works and she doesn't go out. I just need to go out more. Weirdly, I've talked to people, went out walking in the mountains, and people seem to be really friendly and talkative there. I need to do more walking. Dog walkers, they always chat. Yeah, get a dog. Because they are, we all chat to each other, dog walkers. Have you got a dog?
I have, yeah.
What have you got?
A Sprocker Spaniel.
Oh, one of those. There's mad. So many. Yeah, well, of course, Spaniels are mad as a box of frogs, aren't they?
Yeah, it's crazy. Yeah. But yeah. I used to make a point of actually saying hello to everybody I come across. Everybody.
Yeah, it is really nice. And my husband and I, the new one, when we're walking, we can always tell, because, like, we say hello when we walk past them, and the locals all say hello, but the non-locals always look a bit embarrassed, or they either ignore you or they look a bit, you know, embarrassed.
Think you're mad, yeah.
Yeah. And my new husband and I have a really good game where we sit opposite the seafront. We've got an upside-down house for the view, and we sit and watch, and we do a who looks like their dog cop thing. And there's so many people that look like their dogs. I'm not saying you look like a Sprocker. I'd have to see your dog. Yeah, is it male or female?
He's very, very good. So
is he? Oh, very handsome. He's Does he wear a gilet?
No, he doesn't.
And a white jumper?
No, he doesn't. No.
Yeah, but we do. And I'll send you a picture that my husband took, and this woman looked exactly like her dog. It is quite strange, but that's our game that we play. We're very sad, sad people. We have the owners of a popular cafe and shop say rising costs have had a detrimental impact after announcing its sudden closure. So this is very sad. This is in Ramsgate, and I love Ramsgate. It's the Archive Home Store and Kitchen in Ramsgate, and it'll shut its doors for the final time tomorrow after staff revealed the news. And the venue is by the harbour there, and it's become a popular spot for locals and tourists over the past 8.5 years. But the owner, who's Naomi Grady, she says after COVID and rising costs with energy and lighting and all that stuff and everything costing more, it's left her with no option but to close, which is really, really sad. Yeah, you know, we love our independent. Everybody out there needs to go and support local shops and independent. Make a trip to your butcher, your baker, make the effort. Because otherwise, in 3 or 4 years, you'll have no choice. It'll all be the same. Amorphous. Is amorphous a word? I think it is.
It probably could be.
Yeah. Intune PR, he's just popped up, and he says, good lunchtime. So you read that ages ago.
Yeah.
That's only just popped up.
Okay, well, I read it ages ago. Anyway, I'm fed up talking to you. I want to talk to Paul.
I'd love to talk to Paul.
It's an absolute pleasure to welcome, and I try really hard not to, by sending him to the wrong place. Well, I've done it. I'm a nightmare at the moment. It's a really great pleasure to welcome Paul Ribbons to the Business Bunker Show. Paul, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Absolute pleasure. Sorry about this morning.
Don't worry about it. It happens.
He's had a lovely cup of tea, and he's got 4 biscuits, which he hasn't touched, actually, and they're custard creams.
Oh, no.
Sugar.
I can't have them. No, I'm on a sugar-free. I'm on a 90-day protocol. I'm on month 2. First week was tough. Now, fine. Yeah, feeling good.
Good.
Better energy.
Yeah, more energy, yeah.
Cool.
Paul's on a protocol, aren't you?
Yeah, get fat.
he drinks, you know, fizzy drinks and, like, sugar-free, but I don't approve of them either. But, you know, you can't
do anything right, can you, today?
Sorry?
You can't do anything right today.
You can't.
It's not just today, mate. No, it's not just today.
You can't teach an old dog new tricks.
Yeah, true.
I'm teetotal, and there's not much else to drink. I drink tea and coffee and Coke Zero.
My nickname is Perrier.
Right, okay, yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. With a squeeze of lemon, I put real lemon juice in. And sometimes I juice ginger root and put that in. It's quite nice with a squeeze of lemon.
I've got one in really posh taps where actually sparkling water comes out.
Oh, really?
Oh, wow, okay. Yeah, yeah.
I've got a hot tap and a filter tap, but I haven't got sparkling one.
Oh, you started her off now, Paul.
So yours is three-way.
Yeah, three-way, yeah.
Oh, I've only got a two-way.
Kuka.
Ooh. Yeah, you've got the Kuka. Yeah. I found that very expensive, so yes. I went for mine is a, can't remember what mine is, but mine's only two-way. Mm. Oh, I've got envy.
I looked at it this way. The amount of money I would save on sparkling water.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Would pay for it in a year. So.
Yeah, exactly. I'm going to upgrade.
Mm.
Yeah.
Good choice. Shall we start talking to Paul now?
Yeah, about what he does, because he does seems to do an awful lot.
He does.
And, he's one of those entrepreneurs, which, you know, it could be anything, can't it?
It can, and he's got a lot of experience in property, but other things too. And he's actually given me a copy of his book, which we'll talk about in a minute too. Mm. So, Paul, let's start at the beginning. Give us a bit of an overview about Paul, a bit of your background. I know you've got a kind of interesting background, so we won't go into too much depth about that, but just tell us a little bit about you.
Well, I grew up in Walthamstow, East London, which is very trendy now. It wasn't then.
Absolutely.
It wasn't
yeah.
then. I was dragged up down Walthamstow Market, and it was a tough upbringing, and they thought I didn't care, and I couldn't be bothered, but they didn't realise I had dyslexia. So, I grew up in a really rough neighbourhood, eventually left school, went into baking. My dad said to me, if you get into food, clothing or housing, you can't go wrong.
Yeah.
So I looked at it. Well, I had a Saturday job in the bakers, and I thought, well, that'll do. That was my career choice.
Right.
No qualifications or anything like that. So I did that for 8 years, and all I kept thinking to myself is I was better than this. Mm. I was better than this. And I got to 23 years and 20 days old and realised I'd lived longer than my mother had. Because she was 23 when she died.
Oh, wow.
And I thought, do you know what? I'm not going to live my life mediocre anymore. I've got to do something. So I decided to buy a flat, which was quite bizarre at the time because everyone didn't think I was, you know, capable of even buying a flat.
If you don't mind me asking, when was this roughly?
How
1986.
Old were you?
Okay.
How old were you?
23, 27, yeah. 23, 24.
Yeah.
So I bought this.
In Walthamstow, was it?
In Walthamstow, yeah. And it's funny because I remember delivering papers to this particular road, in Car Road in Walthamstow. It was just by Lloyd's Park. And they were called Warner Flats, and they looked like a Victorian house with two front doors.
Oh, lovely.
So, and I remember looking at it, then and that road, thinking, one day I want to live here. Mm. And I bought a flat actually in Carlisle.
Really?
And it was a deal as well. It was really cheap. Mm. I bought it, and then within 9 months, it'd gone up from £28,000 to 42. Mm. I mean, it's crazy if you think about how quickly that's... I mean, man. Anyway, so while I was there in the flat, I sold it for 42 grand. I was watching the estate agent, and I thought... And I've got a mantra. I've always had this mantra. Oh, if I see you doing something... And I think, I can do it. I can do that. Mm. So I was watching the estate agents selling my flat, thinking I could do that. So I said to the guy, so how'd you get into this game then? He said, well, you know, what qualifications have you got? I haven't got any. And I said, so what's your background? He said, he used to be a quick fit fitter. So I went, oh, they take anyone then, do they? So he said, no. He said, I did that while I was at university and I got my university degree. So I said, yeah, but you don't really need to know how many wives Henry VIII had to sell houses, do you, right?
Exactly.
So I said, you know, you've got to be good at sales. And anyway, I convinced him to give me a job.
Wow, okay.
And so I landed up with working in the estate agents and I went through the 90s. Do you remember the 90s recession?
Yes, I lived through it with a mortgage.
Crazy.
Yeah, yeah.
And so anyway, I was working through that really hard recession and I'd done all right. And then met a woman, had kids, got married, then went for a nasty divorce within that 10-year period. Mm. And I sat there thinking, I don't want to work 24/7. Never see my kids, because that was one of the reasons why I got divorced, because I was never at home. Mm. So I decided to go self-employed. So I bought myself a little house so I could take my kids there, went self-employed. And all I did was I used to run for a couple of developers. So I'd go and find a couple of properties for them, get a commission for it. So it's opposite to an estate agent, which is an acquisition agent. Mm. So I started doing that for a little while. And then one of them said to me, look, why don't you put all the... I'll put all the money up and we'll go 50-50. I said, yeah, I'll have some of that, you know, great, you know, give me the money, I don't mind. So off I went to buy a property, and I found one in Forest Gate in East London, and it was, there's a technical term for it, I can't really say it on the air, but it begins with F and it ends with D, right? It was really bad. Oh, it was so bad. And I exchanged...
Falling down, was it?
Falling down, yeah. Yeah. Too. And I want you to imagine this, right? So, because obviously I'm talking to your listeners and they can't see me, but... The bay on the house, on this Victorian house, had literally dropped out, so you could see cracks in it. Mm. As you go into the house, one side of the house to the other, the floors sloped 6 inches.
Wow.
Now, if you was going to play marbles, you'd want to go second. You wouldn't want to go first, right? So it was that bad, right? So, and you felt a bit seasick as you was in that house. And then the back addition where the bathroom and the kitchen are and the third bedroom.
Oh, I remember those, yeah.
It broke away from the back of the house, right? So I was thinking this is going to cost about 25, maybe 30 grand to do up. And then I exchanged contracts with my new partner's money, and then Bob the builder went round. His name was Bob. Right?
Really?
So Bob went round. He went, "What's the budget?" I said, 25, maybe 30. He went, "Double it." I went, "What, 50? He went, "No, 60. And I went, we're talking, this is 1997, right? That's a lot of money. You could build a house for that, right?
Yeah.
He said, "Look, it's honestly, it's that bad. I've got to strip it back to the brickwork. I've got to get rid of all the floors, the ceilings, the timbers. Everything's got to go. Back to brick. Rebuild the bay, rebuild the back addition. You've got to redo the foundations. It is a massive job." The house, I paid 40 grand for the house, and the house was worth, done up, 80, 85 grand. Well, I'm good at maths. 60 and 40 is 100 grand. I'm losing money from day one. So my business partner said, "Look, just dump it." So I'm thinking, dump it, get our money back. He's, "No, no, no. You're going to make a loss in 10 months' time, so you might as well do the loss now. Just sell it for 20. I'm thinking, "No." And he said, "You remember 50-50? 50-50 means 50-50 profit or loss. Right. So I'm thinking, this is 10 grand, and plus my costs. I can't do that on the first house, on the very first deal we've done. So I screwed up in a big way.
Right.
So we chucked this property in the auction, and we're sitting now watching the auctioneer going, "Anyone's going to get any bids on this?" Now, there's a formula for auction. You've got to have a really crappy house for people to get excited, and it's got to be cheap. So it started off at 25 grand. No one was bidding. So the auctioneer's gone, "Well, someone give me a bid." And someone went, "20 grand. So he said, "I've got a bid. Bid of 20,000. And then it went at 22, 25. I'm selling this, like, because he's got to the reserve. And then all of a sudden, there's loads more hands go up. 28, 30, 32, 35. And it carried on going, carried on going, carried on going. And I'm sitting there. You remember Del Boy when he falls over? This is a moment, right? £52,750 it sold for.
Wow.
And I thought, "Oh, what happened there?" Now, I'm a great believer in it. I've always been this way. The property game has got absolutely nothing to do with property. It's to do with people and psychology and understanding that psychology, what had happened. So I studied what had actually happened in that room that day and thought, okay, so let's find some cheap houses that need loads of work and just chuck them in an auction. And so that screw up, I've been screwing up ever since. Honestly, I've just keep putting them in the auction, and it still works today. All this, I mean, we've done...
Can I ask, did you buy them at auction in the first place?
No, we bought them.
No, he bought them himself.
Right.
Yeah, state. We find houses off the open... one of the reasons why this works is I'm looking for three things, right? I don't like to buy houses off poor sods who are getting repossessed. I don't like that. It's taking advantage of
someone. You've got a heart.
Oh yes, I like to think so.
Yeah.
I'm a God-fearing person, so I don't particularly want to stand at the pearly gates and say, "Well, you robbed that granny and you robbed that granny," right? So I'm looking for something specific, right? I want to know the circumstances why it's being sold, but more importantly, is there any leverage? Is there a problem? So that house had a major problem. Now, we could have solved it, but we would have been out of pocket had we bought it, kept it rather, and done it up. But there are plenty of houses out there that have got problems that we can solve, because that's always in the back of our mind when we buy something. Can we solve that problem? Can we solve it within a budget? Yes, we can. Okay, so now we know, what's the worst scenario? This is going to cost us X.
Yeah.
If we can live with that, then I'll just, okay, we'll buy it.
Sorry to interrupt, because it's a fascinating story. But I guess that's also the case that you're looking to move on houses, but there could be someone out there that says, "I really want to live here, and this is the only chance I've got. And although I've got to spend a lot of money doing this house up, I'm going to live in it for 10 years, 15 years. It's going to be my home, and I want it." So... You've got those conflicting reasons for buying things.
It's interesting. I remember going into an auction once when there was a house we had in Strood in Kent. And again, this was had, he had a problem. It had ivy growing on the front of the house, and the ivy roots had grown through the mortar, and it was coming through in the basement. It had a tree trunk chopped down right by the back addition, so you knew that was going to cause a problem with the foundations. Again, bought it right price, put it in the auction. I'm standing in Clive Emerson's auction when they used to have a physical auction.
Yeah.
And whilst we're in the auction, there was two Asian guys, one at the front and one bit in front of me. And they were both from different castes. And there was a bit of a swinging competition going on, right? So the guy in front of me talks to his mate and says, I ain't letting him have it. And he's bidding on my house, right? So I said, I leant over and went, yeah, don't let him have it, mate. Don't let him have it. So they're just hammering tongs until they paid what I would class as level money. Level money being what you would pay for that house done up.
Right.
It sold for level money in that auction room just because that guy didn't want him to have it.
Right.
Which is...
You're talking about human nature, then. You're talking about...
Psychology, yeah.
Psychology is bonkers. I mean, I'm kind of wondering why people sell below market value as well. Why don't they get a proper valuation?
This is the thing, right? Because I'm looking for leverage, these properties are available that anyone could purchase. Anyone. 80% of the properties I've bought have been through estate agents with on Rightmove. What I'm looking for is, I understand, because I was an agent for 10 years, I understand that you are going to have a certain percentage of properties that go under offer and don't go through. And they come back on because a surveyor's gone round there and he said, this is wrong with this. Yeah, I mean, bought one in Ashford.
Surveyors are terrible. Yeah, everything. Yeah.
So we had one in Ashford recently. It looked a beautiful red-bricked Edwardian terraced house with a beautiful double bay on the front, sash double glazed windows. They were very expensive windows. It looked beautiful. Go inside, it was like a TARDIS, and also it was like a time warp. Mm. All the old original fireplaces. This Lovely. Is the sort of stuff. We were talking earlier about you doing houses up. Yeah. You'd have done this one up left, no problem. But it'd been under offer to someone else first, via an estate agent, and the previous owner had had the roof... completely loft insulated with a spray on insulation,
right,
which then stops the timbers from breathing, which then causes a problem with some of the mortgage. Well, you just cut this whole market down by 50% because all of a sudden mortgage buyers can't buy that.
Right.
So it's only open to cash buyers. And we've stepped in and said, yeah, we'll have that. We'll buy that. And it was on the market for 300 because of its problem. Now, do you remember I said earlier, we look at it and we think, can we solve that problem? Right. Well, you can't just take off this spade insulation. Mm-hmm. You have to take the whole roof off. Right. So it's the timbers, the slates, the whole lot. So we've budgeted that for that, which is going to be about 15 grand today to do a decent roof. So we thought if we've budgeted for that, it's not a problem. So we've offered them 250 grand. They've taken it. We've exchanged contracts immediately and gone straight to completion. So they've had their money in a week, because that's another reason why we do what we do. We've got the cash to do it. And then we bought that and sold that for 312 grand in the auction, literally within a couple of weeks of buying it.
Right, okay.
So, but it's understanding we're not actually buying, we buy it below what you would appear to be market value, but there's usually a reason why I'm paying the price.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And people are happy to take that money for it. I just need to get rid of it. Yeah.
The psychology works for buying as well as selling.
Yeah, absolutely. It's like anything like that, though, isn't it? Especially if you're not buying as an investment, but you're buying to move house. Mm. You know, a lot of people get very precious about how much money they want for their house, but it's actually a function of what you're trying to achieve here.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah? Mm. You know, because if you're moving somewhere and that's cheaper too, then
that's a classic example. If I bought my house was new, off plan, and it was a very unusual size for a modern house. It was 2,500 square foot, and you don't often find them at that builders buying at that level. I wouldn't know. So when I saw it, I saw the plan, I thought, this is going to be really swanky.
Right.
So I thought, I want that. And then I did a part exchange on my own house. Now, instead of thinking, I could have got another 15, 18 grand, maybe 20 grand more if I'd have sold it myself, I didn't want the aggro. Mm. So as far as I was concerned, you take my house in part exchange. I've saved the agent fees.
Yeah.
Take it, off you go, and I've got that certainty. And I understand what drives people mad. As an agent, I knew this. It's the uncertainty of not knowing what the eventual outcome will be drives people nuts.
Yeah, yeah.
So if we understand that this is a very emotive business, one of the most stressful things that people can do is buying or selling a house. So I understand that. And I play into the greed, and so I will say this clear, greed of people going to auction thinking they're going to be stealing my house.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
They're going to steal it, all right? Because I put it in very low, guide it very low. That's the gamble.
Yeah.
Because if it's a bad day, and it's happened, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Where there's one person to buy it, you know, we could be having a bad day in the auction. But we understand that people go and they look, they see the guy price, they think, oh, we might be able to nick that. They go to there thinking they're going to nick it. They're looking to make money out of it. And there's two things they do. All right? I've seen this all the time. Very few people don't do these two things. Right? One, they underestimate the cost of the works and they overestimate its price on the other side.
Mm. Right. Yeah.
So you bring them two together. They think they can pay a lot more than I would pay because they can think they can do a refurb for £2.50.
Mm.
Now, they think they get a paintbrush and paint it. And I mean, have you had building quotes recently?
Oh, yeah. Crazy. Through the roof.
My daughter's spending £200,000 on a wraparound extension.
Yeah, that used to be build your own house.
You could have bought your house, easily.
Yeah.
So today it's very expensive to do any building, especially if you're employing a builder.
Mm.
But we understand that people go to... Let's get something straight, right? Let's get something. Property is a sexy business.
Right? Yeah.
You know, people think automatically, if you're involved, there's a certain appeal. So people want to get involved.
Yeah.
Mm. So they can't help themselves. Yeah. We was talking earlier, Jules, about you love doing houses up.
I love it. Gives me a buzz.
Yeah, it gives you a buzz. Mm. And there's a certain, je ne sais quoi about in doing a house up and making it look really smart. Mm. And people love that idea.
Mm.
And I literally sell into that. I want them to think they're going to do that. Yeah. I don't mind. Let them fight.
Yeah.
And it's funny because we bought one in Whitstable in Kent during the pandemic years. And we bought it, and it was two flats. It had a problem because it didn't have planning permission for two flats. I knew how to solve the problem, so I ended up buying it. Because it was it didn't have planning permission, and we put that in auction. And because today auctions are very different. When I was a young lad, I could see people in the room.
Mm.
Now it's on a screen.
Yeah,
it's online. It's like, you know. So you get these two. You can see the screen. You see the auctions. Whoever's bidding, you've got their initials and a colour. So it's very specific, and I can see them bidding against each other.
Right.
And this particular house in Whitstable, you could see that there was two of them going hower and tong, £2,000, £2,000, £2,000. Just kept going up and up and up and up and up. And it just went crazy. And because they're not under pressure in an auction room, because the old days, you'd have Clive Emerson standing there going, you're not going to lose it for £500, are you? Yeah. You had that pressure.
Yeah.
Where today it's online. People have got time with their calculators to tap in and, I could pay a bit more for that.
Yeah.
So things have changed a lot in the last couple of years as well.
Okay.
So, to our advantage as well.
Okay. I want to kind of move along a bit now. You've written a book.
Yeah, I have, yeah.
Yeah. What inspired you to write the book? What's the book about and how's it going?
The book's 10, 11 years old now.
Oh, right, okay.
In fact, it's older than that. 2011, I wrote it. And I wrote it because it was probably the best business card that you could ever have.
Right.
You know, how much authority do you get when you say, yeah, I've written a book? So I was doing lots of training for investors around the sort of 2010, 11, 12, 13 era. And so I thought, and I had a course, and the course was about how to buy properties off the open market.
Right.
And we used to distress them in the old days, make them look a bit worse. We called it our enhancement program. So you'd, you know, build it up or something like that. Or but as long as you could get round and make, you know, you could walk around the house, but we'd try and make it a little bit worse. And so, and then we would teach people how to fund it. And then we'd teach them how to actually sell it via auction. Because there's certain things we do in auction where we can maximize the sale for ourselves or get the best possible price, choosing the right auctioneer. So I thought, okay, what do I do? So I sat down and literally penned exactly what I do from start to finish. And that's what the book is about. So if someone wants to learn how to do it, and it's got stories of how I've bought, because I've been involved. I can't stress this, right? My experience is the depth of it is, and the breadth is vast. And I've probably been involved in 800 transactions since 97. Some of them haven't gone through auction. Some have been traded to other traders because I've got mates of mine who've got big portfolios. They love being landlords. Uh-huh. Can't think of anything worse myself. And I've supplied their portfolios for them, you know, 100, 150 houses. You know, I've secured and sold them on to them. So out of that all them transactions, so there's lots of stories I use of different things, of why things work. Because, again, can't stress this. Got absolutely nothing to do with property. It's about psychology. So I talk about psychology in that book. And it still sells today. It's probably done about 10,000 copies in its lifetime. And I do promote it now and again. I don't promote it the way I should, really.
But and where do we buy it?
Amazon.
On Amazon, great.
It's called Hustle Your Way to Property Success by Paul Ribbons. Love it or hate it, there's no in between.
Exactly.
Absolutely. I want to ask you something. I know you've just said that auctions are different things now because a lot of it's
online. So they're all online or there's still some old-fashioned ones?
There's two types online. You've got what I call a digital, which is a platform very similar to eBay where people are bidding. And then you get the virtual auction where you get an auctioneer with a gavel and he's looking at the screen and he's looking at he's got a camera on him and he's orchestrating it from a screen and a few telephone bids, which I think is
So it's global now. If somebody wants to buy a house in Whitstable, they can do it from Japan or wherever.
There's also, I can't remember the term for it now. When my son was looking, we came across them all the time with very cheap houses, estate agents selling houses, but you have to bid for them.
Yeah, it's called Modern Method of Auction.
That's him. Yeah.
Modern Method.
It's a company called I Am Sold. I think it'll be outlawed eventually because what they do is they charge 4.8% of the purchase price up front.
Yeah.
As soon as your bid's been accepted.
Yeah.
And you don't exchange. Yeah. That's just the fee you pay to the auctioneer. Yeah.
Wow.
4.8%.
Yeah. I saw Jamie came across a couple of houses and he asked me what it was. And I don't know. I Googled it and there wasn't a lot of information about it. But when I looked at the deal, I just thought, I don't like that.
It's become very, honestly, most estate, and this is what, there's only two people it benefits. It doesn't benefit the vendor. It doesn't benefit the purchaser. Yeah. It benefits the auctioneer and the agent.
Yeah.
So agents are pushing people down that route because they get their fee straight away.
Yeah.
You know, and that's wrong. That's wrong.
Yeah. The question I was going to ask you before that, though, is I don't think I've ever been to an auction. And a lot of people have a nervousness about auctions where they think if they accidentally cough, they're going to buy something.
No. I've actually been, is that a bid, Paul? Yeah. No, it's not. Because I was talking to someone again, very animated. Right? So you've got to be, the auctioneer will double check your bid. It's like I scratch my nose and I bought the house. And it's 200 grand. Yeah. It's crazy.
But a lot of people think that, don't they? They're terrified.
But we have noticed on these online auctions, some people start bidding, don't realise they've got to pay the 10%.
Right.
Now, unaware, they haven't done their homework.
Okay,
they think, oh, I'm going to buy that and put by £5,000. They don't realise that's normally because on a normal auction you exchange contracts there and then, and you pay your 10% deposit. It's not a fee; it's a deposit, and that goes towards your completion monies. Mm. So on a normal auction, it's fairly straightforward. Mm. But if you've just exchanged on something and then you realise, oh, what do you mean I've got to come back with the money in 28 days? You know, we've had a few recently where they've not completed because of that reason.
Okay. Mm. What happens under those circumstances?
We take their money.
Right, okay.
That's as simple as that. The 10% gets paid to us because they're under contract. There's a difference.
And you have to be a cash buyer to go to an auction?
No, you don't.
Don't you? No. So, you can go with a mortgage or?
Well, it depends on what sort of mortgage. You can do bridging. Bridging finance is available literally from any.
Bridging is hideous, though, isn't it? Isn't it really dangerous?
I've used bridging before.
Do you?
It depends. I think it comes down to two things, right? Bridging is very flexible for short-term, very short-term borrowing. Mm. And it can be very cost-effective depending on what you're doing. Mm. If you're buying something and then you're going to do it up and then refinance it afterwards, that can be quite a good strategy. But you've got to be confident for your exit.
Yeah.
Because if you can't exit that bridging, it could cost you dearly.
Mm. Yeah.
I borrow money that that's reasonable rates, 0.5% a month or it might be a... 0.75% a month, and no entry fee, but maybe an exit fee. But I've seen people lose their properties because they weren't aware of what the auction bridging conditions were. So, got to be very, very careful. And I'd say it's for very experienced investors.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So, property is one of those things, isn't it? We kind of half discussed, because Jules doesn't like new house building. We both went, no, you've got to build houses, because we just have a massive shortage of houses, especially in the southeast.
Yeah, but the houses they're buying are unaffordable for young people. They're like 550 plus around us.
If that was the case, they wouldn't sell them. Hmm.
They're empty. Where we are in Whitstable, loads of them, they're not selling. There've just been 500 builders laid off with one of the big developments.
Yeah, you have to look at the
because
the
they're not sold.
You do get silly stuff happens. Mm. Yeah, I'll give you an example. Years ago, I had a house in Cornwall, and North Cornwall District Council were getting very upset with grockles. Tourists that come in and buy up all the homes as well.
They called grockles.
Yeah.
Or Emmets.
Yeah. So they built a housing estate next to my house.
DFLs in Whitstable.
Yeah, down from London, yeah.
They built a housing estate next to my house in Cornwall of 15 houses. Mm. And they said they can only be purchased by locals. Mm. And they were lower cost houses. Mm. After 5 years, they hadn't sold a single one. And the reason being is no mortgage company would give you a mortgage on a house they couldn't repossess and sell.
Yeah, because who are you sell it to? Yeah. A local who can't afford it anyway.
So, exactly. So they didn't sell a single one of them. Yeah. And eventually they just put them on the open market.
That's an anomaly because it's very unusual that to happen. It's very unusual for a big estate to be... Because what builders tend to do is they'll build so many, release, and if they've got no demand for them, they'll stop the build. Mm. Yeah. They'll deliberately stay, they'll hold it up because they don't want a load of empty stock because it costs some money. So it's unusual to find that.
Yeah.
But I think we're going to see more buildings.
Well, I know that the councils, as Wandsworth and I think it's another one, I can't remember, Lewisham, who are sending, you know, council tenants to these houses. So maybe there's been a delay in that. I don't know.
One of the other things I came across recently as well, and I might have got this wrong, and forgive me if I've maligned you, London and Quadrant, but at one of the big housing building companies in London, I think it was London and Quadrant, but it might not have been, have stopped selling the houses that they're building, and they only rent them.
Yeah. Well, London Quadrant are a housing association.
Right. Okay.
That's what they are. They're not house builder. They're a housing association.
I've got that wrong. It's some house builder was building houses in London but refused to sell them. They would only rent them out.
Yeah. I think there's something also, a very, very big scheme with the government called the build to rent scheme. Mm. So they're encouraging large corporations. They don't want the small landlord anymore because the small landlord is actually a hindrance to the
letting
market.
That's what I said to you before. Well,
they are a hindrance. Yeah. The reason being is because they debted themselves up and someone can't even afford to put new boilers in and stuff like that. So they don't want that kind of issue down the road.
Yeah.
So they're looking at large corporations.
Yeah, like in the US.
Yeah. Mm. So you've got something like Legal & General or...
Well, Lloyds Bank bought 11,000 houses.
So we always end up following the US.
We are very, very unique. In the UK, we're very unique compared to other countries. Mm. And one of those is our rental laws. Mm. I mean, you go anywhere else in Europe and you can rent somewhere for your life.
Yeah.
You can't here.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sure. And if you think about it logically, you had this dichotomy, which is, you said earlier, young people can't afford to buy. Mm. But you've got this problem with if you're a youngster and you want to settle down, what's your options?
Yeah.
Mm. And I can never understand this. So you've got a landlord who rents the property for 6 months. It's someone's home.
Yeah.
Mm. And they're only going to be there for 6 months.
And they're moving
year.
Around constantly. Yeah.
So,
horrible.
So there's a social responsibility from the local authority or the housing associations. They should build more houses for people like that because they can't afford it. And they shouldn't be reliant on a landlord that's effectively not got the social responsibility. Mm. He's looking at a financial responsibility because he's got a mortgage on his house.
Yeah.
So you've got this problem, an issue with housing, and it will get resolved eventually.
But the thing I think about rental is if people are paying high rents, like, you know, My daughter's paying 1,006. Okay, she's got a house, but she rents that out, can't live in it. But she's paying 1,006 in Greenwich. And, you know, say she stayed there, once she's retired, how do people pay that rent, you know, on a pension?
The social.
She'll never do that.
No, but that's what happens. That
they then have to slide off.
Yeah, the burden will be on the social.
I don't think a lot of people have thought about that. Once you stop work, unless you're very wealthy and you've got a great pension, how do you pay that rent?
Well, you just get housing allowance. You know, that will support our older generation, which are getting older, as we know.
And
there's a lot of people. There's a lot of elderly in Whitstable. We've got lovely big houses, but to move down to scale out is emotional sometimes, but also costs a lot of money to move now, you know, with stamp duties and solicitors
and it's difficult because I live in a 5-bedroom house and all my kids have flown the nest. So what do you do? You know, I don't need the bedrooms, but I don't want to give up the ground floor space.
Exactly.
So what do you do? Buy a bungalow? Lopsided? No, I'm not ready for bungalows. Maybe 60, but I'm not that old. So I look at it and think, we really should, if we're doing the right thing, is sell that and move into a smaller property. But I don't want to.
But also it would be, you'd be losing money because you're spending money to do it.
It's one of those funny things, you know. Paul hit a nail on the head earlier on when he said the property market isn't about houses, it's about people and emotions. And we really, you know, you were going on about Sunak earlier and he's coming out with his nonsense about farms. Politicians do this all the time, or they look at things in a really weird way. The vast majority of people, like my mum, for instance, she does live in a bungalow. She's 95, she has dementia, she could sell a bungalow. Yeah. But why? She wouldn't, if she moved, she wouldn't know anyone. She wouldn't know where she was. She wouldn't know what area she was in. Now that's an extreme case, but a lot of people grow up in an area. They don't want to move. They don't want to move out of their area. Yeah. But especially again in the southeast, it's incredibly expensive. And you also get a lot of this, especially with younger people. And I have some degree of sympathy with this that says, oh, well, it's all right for the boomers. You all bought your houses cheap and now they're worth a fortune.
But when we had interest rates of 17%.
Exactly. I was just going to say, I bought my first house in 1979. And at the beginning of the year, it was 8%. By the November of that year, it was
17%. 17% in 1979, the base rate. And my first mortgage was 14.5%. And that was 12.5% base rate, the mortgage rate. And then I had 1% because it was built before 1919.
Yeah.
Come on, don't take the mickey. Right? I can't help it if it was built before. And 1% because I had to borrow 100% because I was about to buy my house. And then I'd had a car accident about 6 months beforehand and my insurance wouldn't pay out. So the guy, I had to buy it to pay for his damage on his car.
Oh, wow.
So my deposit went there. So they charged me an extra 1% because I borrowed 100%. So, you know, so I think we had it tougher. I think it's, if you think about it, I predicted this boom that we've had in the last probably 10 years. I went back to 2012, wrote a report and said house prices will double in 2 to 5 years, especially in London. And they did. They did. They went bananas from 2012 to 2016. And that was going to ripple out. But something happened in 2016. We voted to leave the European Union. So there was a lot of people who went, I'm going to sit on my hands for a little while, just wait. And the transaction numbers dipped substantially in 17, 18, 19. So we knew once we left the European Union, 2019 December, that 2020 was going to be a good year for property. Right. And then we had that scenario where pandemic years come along. Everyone was thinking
they wanted a bigger garden, they wanted to move out and
so you space. People thought that, right? But it was going to be a natural phenomenon when house prices in London had gone up so fast, you always get a ripple effect. People come straight out. I'm down from London myself. I used to live in London and I moved to Kent. I know so many people who've come outside of London.
Yeah.
Not because they wanted more space, because they couldn't afford London anymore. So we knew this boom was coming. And then everyone equated it to, this was the silly move. The government thought, we've got to do something. What do? We stimulate the economy. Let's get rid of stamp duty for a period of time. Well, you force everyone to buy at the same time because they're saving their stamp duty. Well, what are you going to do? You've had this pent-up demand from 2016 anyway, coupled with stamp duty changes. Bang, everyone jumps in at the same time and you get that spike in property prices. So but if you think about, and this is the way I look at it, right? My daughter bought a house, and you talk about can't afford it. My first mortgage was £62,000, was costing me £850 a month. I was a baker, right? And it was burning up 45% of my salary.
Right.
I was paying £850 a month with the do you remember you used to have endowment and the interest only?
Yeah.
My daughter was paying £1,200 for a 300 grand mortgage repayment, not interest only. And that was 40 years later.
Right.
And her and her husband earned substantially more than I did. Substantially. Right. So they're only a fraction of. Do you know what the average deposit is today for the first time buyer?
60K?
60K. And percentage wise, from loan to value?
10%?
19% deposit they put down. Do you know what it was prior to 2008?
No.
94%. Wow. Prior to 1990, 94%.
Right.
So since 2008, when everything changed, people have had to put big chunks down, and they're getting used to putting big chunks
down. Yeah.
They're saving money. Mm. So if they couldn't afford it, where does that come from?
Yeah.
And it's not just coming from a bank of mum and dad. These people are saving the money.
Mm-hmm.
And that's nationwide.
Right. Mm.
But the interesting thing for me, because I do a lot of research, because I need to know, as a trader, I need to know where the market's going, what's going to happen. And one of the things I learned when back in 2012, when I did the report, in 2012, the average first-time buyer's salary was 38 grand. The average.
Right.
Not joint, individual, nationwide, right? Now, that shocked people, because the average income was at the time was 26 grand.
Right.
It's probably 30-odd thousand now.
It's 32, yeah.
32.
Yeah.
So at the time, it was 38 grand. Now, the average first-time buyer salary now is 44 grand, right? The average person doesn't buy a house anymore.
Right.
They rent.
Yeah.
That average, like that 30 grand, and will be renting.
Yeah.
So what do you do?
Yeah.
What do you do with them who can't afford? Because since 2008, through no fault of their own, they've not been able to buy a house.
Yeah.
Because they had to rent somewhere because they wouldn't be granted a mortgage.
Because
they'd have been granted a mortgage prior to 2008 because the banks were in trouble. They tightened up. Mm. What do these people do? And you talk about Sunak. He was talking about the 99% mortgage. Did you hear about that?
Yeah.
I think it's a good idea.
Yeah.
Personally, I think it's a good idea. And the reason why it's a good idea, because the tenants can't afford to raise a deposit because they're paying so much rent.
Yeah.
Right? Their rent gives you the affordability meter.
Yeah,
in other words,
if I'm paying
£2,000 a month, that's what I can afford.
Yeah, absolutely.
But their income won't support that, right?
Mm. Yeah. Mm.
So give them 99%, let them go and buy somewhere,
absolutely.
And then you'll get them back into
absolutely,
that.
Yeah. Look, we could talk about this forever. We've only got 2 minutes left of the show. I just want to read this. Martin Reeves has tweeted, "What a super interview with Paul Robbins. Answers so many questions. I've always wondered about the housing industry. I've never been to a property auction, but there is a buzz at any auction."
Mm. And then he says, "When I sold my mum's house in Maidstone last year, the estate agent we use told me that London boroughs bought up all the office space in Maidstone and were converting them to flats.
Yeah.
People can't afford to live in London."
Yeah. Oh, most of my office will go, I'm due to move out of my office in May.
So it'll be turned into flats, will it?
Yeah. Well,
because
most of them started off as houses anyway.
Mm. Yeah. And also the high street's a bit dead at the moment, isn't it? So if you've got people living there, they're going to come down for their coffee and their bakers and their butchers.
We're almost at the end of the show. I just want, Paul, can you give us a shout out? If people want to talk to you, find out more about what you do or...
There's two places you can go. You can contact me via my website, paulribbons.com.
Yep.
Or contact me or connect with me on YouTube. I've got a YouTube channel, which I do a lot of personal development stuff, where I talk about different things and how psychology affects me. So they can, that's at Paul Ribbons on YouTube.
Fantastic. There's a link to that on the Campuses Radio website, so you can find it there if you want to find out more from Paul and find out more about what he does. You can also go and buy his book on Amazon, Paul Ribbins, Hustle Your Way to Property Success. Do go and check that out and buy a copy of that for yourself. Paul, for the moment, thank you so much for that. Absolutely fabulous. Really, we could talk about this for weeks, but yeah.
Can't wait to read the book.
Yeah, absolutely. We're at fairly much at the end of the show. Have you got anything you need to read, Jules?
No, because I've just put it all over there because I thought you were finishing. There's a co-working space.
You can't get a start.
Well, you said you were wrapping up. A co-working space aimed at startups and growing businesses has been given the green light to open inside a shopping centre.
Oh, this is ludicrous.
This is Medway Council's proposal.
This is ludicrous.
It's the innovation hub, she says, snatching her emails back, for the first floor of the Pentagon in Chatham. It's been approved by its planning committee. Approximately half of the first floor of the shopping complex will be transformed into a space offering office space and business mentoring for startups and small businesses.
Yeah.
It will share the floor with the authority's planned Healthy Living Centre, which has recently been allocated more funding. What's the Healthy Living Centre?
Dear Medway Council, can I suggest you make contact with your colleagues in Canterbury Council and ask them what happened when they tried to start a co-working space and how much money they lost.
And how they got rid of the tenants who were paying the rent
exactly.
And left it empty.
Yeah.
Oh dear.
See, it's another example of what I was saying earlier, of councils getting involved in things they don't understand.
Well, they don't run it. I'm very excited. I've got a
copy of
the book.
You've got a book to read.
Yeah.
She'll read that while she's driving home.
Yeah, I will. I'll sit in the back seat.
Amount of people
great
tell me.
Great picture.
Thank you for a few years.
Right, we've got to go. That's the end of the show. Thank you.
Paul will come on again, I think.
Yeah, we'll have Paul back again. Fascinating. I want to say thank you to everybody who took part in the show. Siobhan, Sandy and Mike from Seven Oaks, to Paul Ribbons and my co-host Jill Serkin. She's not here next week. It'll be me and Julie.
It's my 30th anniversary.
Yeah, me and Julie will be here next week. Have a safe week, everybody, and we'll see you all soon. Bye for now.
Thank you, bye.
The Business Bunker with Paul Andrews.